In 2003, an estimated 250,000 people marched in Sydney against the Iraq War. It eclipsed the Vietnam protests. It was the biggest demonstration the city had ever seen. A few days later, an infinitely smaller group of demonstrators met at the same place to campaign for public education. Here's the rub. The first protest was unsuccessful. Australian troops did not pull out of Iraq. Iraq was invaded. But over time, the second protest was successful. The education campaign saw funding increased substantially. My next guest, working at Unions New South Wales, helped organise both campaigns, and the paradox got her thinking about these questions. Why was the small one successful and the large one unsuccessful? And why was I so crazy as to think I'd get a park in the city? She's written a book called Power in Coalition, Strategies for Strong Unions and Social Change. Amanda Tattersall with us now in studio. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning, James.
So the premise of your book is that over the last few decades, unions and community groups have become weaker. But if they form alliances over common interest, it can be in their mutual benefit. Is that how I'm describing it?
Absolutely. But not only have organisations got weaker, but the problems that members of those organisations face have got worse. And so the need for social change is more pressing, and it brings about a need for thinking about new strategies for achieving social change.
How has it got worse?
Oh, in terms of living conditions, I mean, metropolitan urban centres around the world have traffic congestion. We've got out of balance work-family life where people are working longer hours and not able to take care of their kids as much. You know, those sort of problems are the stresses that people are facing.
And community groups and unions are unable to address their concerns about those kinds of things?
Absolutely. I mean, they're getting worse rather than better.
Mm-hmm. So let's take the Iraq War Coalition and the other contrast you made, the education campaign. The war protest, I remember, was unprecedented. Something like 60 organisations came together. Totally unrelated, churches, unions, the works, but they came together with a common interest, namely, we don't want this war in Iraq, but it was to no short or long-term avail. And within days, that coalition, I remember, broke apart.
Mm-hmm.
And you contrast that with the education campaign. Speak more to the detail of that, please.
So, and I was actively involved in that Walk Against the War coalition. And, you know, at one level, it was a textbook great coalition, you know, bigger and better, 60 organisations, everyone under the sun. The trouble was that there was very little that we could actually agree on to do together. So the only thing we could agree on was to have more rallies. And so we had a very, very large rally in February, and then declining demonstrations through after the war occurred, to the point that the coalition ended up tearing itself apart because of the kind of disagreements. There was a lack of common interest and a lack of common ground and trust between the partners. In contrast with the Public Education Coalition, it followed what I describe in the book as a less is more strategy. A couple of organisations with a very deep commitment and common interest to a core issue around public education. Theirs was reducing the sizes of classes for kindergarten kids to year two kids. And that was something that both parents and teachers had a really deep mutual concern for. So they were prepared to work together over 18 months to build political pressure and a movement for change that saw a $250 million policy change from the state Labor government.
That was the alliance, was it? The PNC and the teachers' union?
Yeah, and school principal organisations.
This is the case study you've expand on in detail in the book. You also went to Canada and US to find other examples. What are they?
That's right. So I went to Canada and I researched the Ontario Health Coalition, which is a strong coalition over there, attempting as hard as it can to defend healthcare from the lack of healthcare in the United States. And then I went to Chicago and looked at a different coalition called the Grassroots Collaborative that worked with a retail union over there in a campaign around Walmart. Firstly, a negative campaign against the existence of Walmart, which they weren't particularly successful on, but then later a very innovative campaign seeking to create living wages for Walmart and large retail workers, which they were successful over.
So what are the elements of a successful campaign? Why were they successful where others were not?
Well, there are a couple of... One of them is that rule around less is more, and I sort of draw that out of the different studies. Another important element is being able to build strong relationships between organisations. And so in Chicago, you had organisations come together and build relationships with each other before they started working on issues together. Another important element was similar to what we saw in Australia and Canada, but also what we saw in the Your Rights at Work campaign in Australia more recently, was where a coalition can work at multiple levels. So it can move an agenda across a city, but also it can have local participation from union members and community organisation members. So it's not just about sending out press releases, but it's actually about building a people's movement for change. There's some of the key elements.
You're the Deputy Assistant Secretary, I think I have the title right, at Unions New South Wales. Is this need for alliances reflective of the fact that unions are weak now, basically? And if they weren't weak, you wouldn't need to build these alliances.
I think in part it's true that there's been a crisis of union power. Certainly in the 1960s and 70s, when unions were much stronger, that while they did have relationships sometimes with other organisations, they weren't as necessary because they were able to achieve policy influence on their own. Now, not only are coalitions seen to be important to be able to pursue social issues, whether they be around climate change or transport and so forth, they're actually essential. So whereas in the 1960s and 70s, it tended to be progressive unions, you know, ideologically progressive unions who pursued coalitions, now you're seeing that strategy pursued much more broadly across the union movement.
And yet there remains an argument that unions should stick to core business, arbitration, representing on wages and conditions, and this kind of stuff isn't their business.
Well, I guess the thing is that I say that you can integrate those two sets of concerns. The truth is that, you know, we look at the eight-hour day. There could be nothing more core business than how many hours a day you spend at work. But the truth is there's no returning to the eight-hour day till we deal with the issue of congestion and how people get to work, as much as dealing with wages and conditions and collective bargaining. My argument is that unions need to be creative about how we deal with these core problems that people are facing in their working lives, some of which can be pursued through collective bargaining and some of which need to be pursued beyond it.
These alliances you've cited in the book, they're all of a left-wing flavour, but that's your personal political orientation. Does what you have to say about alliances is not limited to the left-wing, is it?
No, not at all. I actually think that the fact that we've had BHP come out and signal that they're interested in the climate change debate is exactly the kind of example of the broad kind of alliances that could be forged between community and business. The strategies I identify are not based on particular ideology. They're based on the mechanics of how organisations can work together more effectively, and many of the lessons apply quite broadly to different relationships between organisations across the political spectrum.
What about the Tea Party movement in the US, within the Republican Party? Is that a major alliance which is achieving outcomes in your view?
Well, I don't think it's particularly an alliance. It's, you know, as described in The New Yorker, it's funded by big billionaires and it's more of a single organisation than it is a coalition of organisations. And they have, of course, the advantage of being backed by the biggest billionaires in the United States. What is interesting, though, in Washington at the moment is in reaction to the Tea Party movement, there's a major coalition emerging. For an Australian, when I heard about it, I thought it was quite so taken back. Their coalition is called the One Nation Working Together Coalition, which was slightly frightening for me. But interestingly enough, the coalition strategies are being used to respond to the challenge of the Tea Party movement.
And what about Australia's hung parliament? Because that's really, you know, demonstrates the need for alliances to be formed right on the floor of parliament.
That, and also to me, the fracturing of political consensus at a federal level provides concrete opportunities for coalition, civil society, community-based coalitions to have more input into public debate. They say, and I found that when political opportunities such as disagreement between political leaders are available, community coalitions are far more likely to be successful. I saw that in the case studies, and I think we'll see that over the next 3 years.
Amanda Tattersall, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The book is Power in Coalition, Strategies for Strong Unions and Social Change. It's published by Allen and Unwin. On ABC Radio National Breakfast, we have the news coming up. How about this for a blast from the past? We'll meet John Madigan after the news. Who's he? He's a blacksmith from Ballarat. So what? Well, he's heading to Canberra as the DLP senator from Victoria. Yes, that's right. DLP, the Democratic Labor Party. They split from Labor in the 50s. I thought they lost all their seats in 1975 and disbanded. No, they're still around, and indeed, they'll be in the federal parliament. Our tech editor, Peter Marks, will be with us as well to look at the latest in smartphones. And should you wear a bike helmet? The bike helmet debate, 8 o'clock.